11th of August, 2015, Jerry Crawford.
Well, I hadn't planned exactly where to start, so where I think I'm supposed to start. Part two, for Tom's benefit and Jane and KK. I covered the Greeks last week, talked a little bit on the Romans, all the way up through Hellenistic Greece. That's the time of Alexander the Great. And then I put in a second ending so I can have two parts. How about that? I want to read you another selection from Francis Schaeffer. And I know you've read it. I don't know if KK has ever read it or not. Have you read it, Helen? How Should We Then Live? Came out about 40 years ago or so. And I really got into it when Bruce and Debbie and Ann and I were in just a little group of about four people in Rockford. And Bruce and I went to a Baptist church and we watched the videos that went along with it, and then we'd get back together and talk. And I never realized at the time quite where I was going with the whole thing, but I've gone back to it multiple times. And we talked about last week the idea that each one of us has a worldview or a presupposition. And I like his comment that it's something you catch, a little bit like the measles. It's, you know, the group of people that you're around,
yeah,
and their attitude and their values and so forth, and you tend to adopt them as well. I'm not quite sure where I got the measles in this case, because it wasn't at home. And I'm not putting my folks down, but it wasn't a Christian home in the sense that I think a Christian home should be. We went to church and that kind of thing, but that's about as far as it went. And it wasn't until I got in Rockford, teaching at the high school, where Debbie was my student, believe it or not. Bruce went there as well, but I didn't have him in class. And we got to going to this big Methodist church that Tom came out of, Court Street Methodist. And I guess God knew what he was doing. I thought he was kind of crazy. He stuck me in the membership and evangelism committee. Well, of all places to be, when you're not even sure you're a Christian, that's not it. But it wasn't too long after that that we got involved in Key 73, which is a Billy Graham crusade. And Leighton Ford was the person who came, and we were in the choir, singing in the choir at Court Street with Paul Waters that Thomas talked about. And I accepted the Lord at that point. And it was in the next 5 years, from 73 to 78, things began to happen. And we ended up with Debbie and Bruce. At that point, they weren't married yet. Her folks, various other people that went to Court Street. And I was supposedly the Sunday school teacher, except part of the time we played Tom Moan tapes and then discussed them. We knew his folks.
I mean,
we knew his folks, and they shared the tapes with us. So we kind of got involved in Tom Moan's ministry that way. And then after doing that kind of thing, singing in the choir, and Ann played the organ there as a substitute for Paul. And I led a youth group at the high school. They let us do it. Most of the time it was not at the building. It was in somebody's home. But I just was getting more dry and more dry. It felt like this was just, there was so much more to what it meant to be a Christian that I had no clue where to go to get it. And Bruce had come down by that point, and then Debbie came down. And in the spring of 1978, we came down to visit. And I think God has a beautiful sense of humor, because one of the things that we did just before we left, I scooped out the driveway in late March, and the snow was over my head on the north side. And in the middle of the yard, it was like 3 feet deep. We drove through a bunch of ice on the way down, got here, and the daffodils were blooming. I thought, I have died and gone to heaven. You remember, I'm a gardener, and daffodils did it to me. And we spent some time talking to Tom and Barb, and what was it, August maybe, I drove your folks down?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Brought them down, and had the experience of riding with his dad, which was an interesting experience, to say the least. And talked to Tom a little bit more. And then we moved down in September of 78. And we've been here ever since, doing our thing and following the leading of the Lord most of the time. There are some times I think I screwed up, but we won't go there. I want to go to a little section on St. Francis Schaeffer again. He talks about Rome. And I mentioned to you last week that there are things in our world, in that worldview, that are coming at us from the philosophic standpoint, which is where we try to figure things out logically, the scientific. Tom read one this morning about a scientific view of what causes us to do what we do. And then, of course, the, quote, religious point of view. And I'm going to start off with that. In many ways, Rome was great, but it had no real answer to the basic problems all humanity faces. Much of the Roman thought and culture was shaped by Greek thinking, which we talked about last week, especially after Greece came under Roman rule in 146 BC. I mentioned last week that one of the ways that they came under Greek thinking is they didn't just hire Greek tutors, they captured them, and a lot of times they were slaves. And they wanted to educate their children, so they brought these tutors into their family and taught their kids that way. The Greeks tried first to build their society upon the city-state, that is, the polis. The city-state, both in theory and in fact, was comprised of all those who were accepted as citizens. And I gave you some numbers. Out of 300,000, no more than 43,000 at the max were ever adult male citizens. 33% or so. 100,000 was slaves. That's a third. So Greek culture, such as it was largely Athenian, but it was sure wasn't democratic in the sense that we use democratic, even though we get our concept of democracy from them. Back to the quote. All values had meaning in reference to the polis. Thus, when Socrates had to choose between death and exile from that which gave him meaning, he chose death. Do you remember how he did it? He drank hemlock. Chose to die rather than, because he refused to live anywhere else that was not civilized. In fact, in the Greek language, the term they used for everybody that wasn't Greek was barbarian. Mm-hmm. Because they thought they barked like dogs. Bar, bar, bar. Mm. But the polis failed since it proved to be an insufficient base upon which to build a society. The Greeks and later the Romans also tried to build society upon their gods. But these gods were not big enough because they were finite, limited. Even all their gods put together were not infinite. Actually, the gods in Greek and Roman thinking were like men and women, larger than life, but not basically different from human men and women. And I mentioned to you that in Greek mythology, the gods came down to earth in many cases and had wives, for want of a better term, had sexual relations with the women, and the result was the heroes in Roman mythology. The gods were amplified humanity, not divinity. Like the Greeks, the Romans had no infinite god. This being so, they had no sufficient reference point intellectually. That is, they did not have anything big enough or permanent enough with which to relate either their thinking or their living. Consequently, their value system was not strong enough to bear the strains of life, either individual or political. All their gods put together could not give them a sufficient base for life, morals, values, and final decisions. These gods depended on the society which had made them. And when the society collapsed, the gods tumbled with it.
Amen.
Thus, the Greek and Roman experiments in social harmony, which rested on an elitist republic, ultimately failed. It took a long time.
Mm-hmm.
The Roman, if you start at the beginning of the Roman civilization, which goes back something like 750 BC, it lasts to about 500 AD, and they usually use 476 AD as the end of the Roman civilization. That's when the city of Rome fell. so that's, you know, in excess of 1,000 years.
Yeah.
How long have we been around?
Over 200.
About 200, 230, 250, something like that. We haven't been around. We're just young sprouts, in a sense.
It really applies to us. When you were reading, I was hearing not Greek and Roman, but I was listening to our society, not having values, not having God's
wisdom
to handle our problems.
Before I go on, one of the things that some of the kids at Metro experienced, and even the ones at Sepulpa when I was over there, as I would finish my section on Rome, I would have them draw a T-chart. I may have even drawn it on her board. But a big chart like so. You put the Romans on one side and the United States on the other, and you start comparing the two, and it'll blow your skull. You know, just all the things that are parallel, and you think, oh my gosh. We may be a young sprout as far as the number of years we've been around, but we've accelerated the fall, I think.
Amen.
The Greeks arrived in Italy, and we're talking about Greeks arriving in Italy, in the southern part of Italy, about 750 BC, and created a colony in southern Greece called Magna Graecia. And most of us don't realize that this is how the Romans first came into contact with the Greeks, because the Greeks were already there. There were several, for want of a better term, states in Greece or in Italy. There was Tuscany. If you've ever been to Florence, that's where Tuscany is, and that's north of Rome. Latium, this was in the center, which ultimately became where Rome itself was founded. And then back in the southern part, you had Campania and various others. And then you had the Greek colonies, Magna Graecia. And they brought with them their culture, especially the growing of grapes and olives, the language, the alphabet. Even the Roman alphabet, by the way, is Greek with a few twists. Their influence was so impressive that some historians consider the Etruscan and early Roman culture as nothing more than a continuation of the Greek. The earliest Roman contact was often through merchants, but later in the second century, they actually conquered the territory and assimilated them. And that's kind of what Rome did. From then all the way to the end, they would assimilate the territories that they took. And as long as you would accept their leadership, they'd leave you somewhat alone. I said somewhat. We'll get to that again. The second group that had a very big impact on Rome was the Etruscans. And I mentioned that they were in the peninsula north of Rome. By 535, they were engaged in wars with the Greeks, who had allied themselves with the Carthaginians. Now, who are they?
From Carthage.
Where was Carthage?
In North Africa.
North Africa, in basically Libya today. Did any of you see the movie that made fun of that whole deal? I'm trying to think of the name of the guy, the American general that was such a character. In World War II.
Patton.
Who thought he was Hannibal reincarnated. And he thought he was from Carthage.
Wow.
He really thought he was. And Carthage was actually a Phoenician settlement. See, the Greeks were not the only people going out and setting up colonies. So were the Phoenicians. You read about Tyre and Sidon in the Bible?
No.
They were Phoenicians. They're the ones where they got the wood to build the temple. You know, they've been around a long time too. And at any rate, all in all, by the peak of their power, which was in the 6th century BC, they're usually given credit for bringing urbanization to Rome. And what I mean by urbanization, the area around Rome, and if you know the mythology, it was created by two brothers, Romulus and Remus, who were found and raised by a she-wolf, which is an interesting mother, but they were raised by a she-wolf, and this was a swampy region along the Tiber River. Yes, Ann?
Where they really?
No. I said mythology. At any rate, they had been, the early Romans were pastoral. They spoke in language that was known as Latin. And for about 100 years, they were influenced very strongly by the Etruscans. They built the first road in the city, in their city, which was north of Rome. It came to be known as the Sacred Way. They constructed temples. They built markets. They had streets and houses. All these things they passed on to the Romans, including the toga. Now, I always thought the toga, which was a glorified bathrobe, was something the Romans came up with by themselves, and they borrowed that too. Yeah. That great big robe.
Borrow a bathrobe.
You know, this is an aside, and I do tend to get aside now and then. You realize that they didn't have pants in those days. They wore these robes. And where did they get the things we call pants? Got them from the Mongols. Can you imagine riding a horse bare-legged? The hair and the sweat and stuff, it would just eat your lunch, wouldn't it? Maybe why they went from being largely cavalry-dominated military to foot soldiers. I don't know. That's a crossword theory. I just can't imagine riding around on a horse bare-legged. Do any of you have a dime with you? If you got one, look at the backside.
I guess you'll be able to see it.
Well, we've been around for decades, Tom mentioned. Remember?
Okay.
What's on the backside?
It's like a cannon. I don't know what it is. See what that is. That's a torch.
Looks like a torch.
Yeah,
it's not.
Looks like a torch.
It's the Roman symbol of authority called a fasces.
Oh, that's
and they even borrowed it from the Etruscans. It was not something they came up with by themselves. So here the Romans are, and we give them all this credit, and there's a lot of credit that can go to them, but they were great borrowers of such ideas, including their alphabet, which was a mixture of Greek and Latin and so forth. We today call it the Latin alphabet. And finally, they borrowed the idea of body armor, which was the Greek symbol. The Greek weapon of their troops, and it was a shield of sorts. Many of the Etruscan weapons helped bring about an emphasis on the infantry. The Etruscans was an emphasis on the infantry. And following about 600 BC, the struggle between the nobles and the last king of the Etruscans, a guy by the name of Servius Tullius, enabled the Romans to finally bring about the end of the Etruscan civilization and the rise of the Roman Republic. Now, the period of time of the Republic goes from 509 to 264 BC. About, what would it be, 250 years? Something like that. And I don't want to go into that period of time in particular, except to say that during that period of time you have the whole conflict between the nobles, or the patricians, and the common people, the plebeians, going on and on for the next 250 years. But out of that comes much of what we know about the Roman Republic. You had the patricians, or the aristocratic minority, who owned the largest estates, and also the most important jobs. Obviously, since they're property owners, they had the best jobs. The two consuls of Rome at this point, they had a consul, were always patricians. They had provincial governors. They had praetors, which are kind of in between the provincial governors and the consuls. I want you to begin to visualize the structure that I'm talking about. And about 300 senators. Now, think about Catholic Church, ultimately, and you see the same structure. Basically, the Catholic Church adopted the Roman structure, almost hook, line, and sinker, ultimately. All in all, yeah, they called it a form of shared power, but sort of. I mean, these senators could make rules, but could they enforce them? Somewhat, yes, somewhat no, depending on who the consuls were. And if the consul happened to be somebody like Julius Caesar, you basically were serving the state under a dictator. The only way you could get him to stop is killing, which they ultimately did. The second group was the, and larger group was the plebeians. Sometimes they owned land. Some of them became merchants and built up their wealth and so forth. Some owned land in their own right. They could not hold political office. They could not intermarry with the patricians to begin with. You are definitely kept down by everything they could come up with. This group we mentioned was called plebeians. They eventually gained significant authority by withdrawing their support from the state. Sounds a little bit like some of the demonstrations you hear about going on right now. And sometimes it got kind of violent. But in the positive side, they were able to finally come up with two people that they selected, and then later on it became 13, called tribunes. Didn't we have a paper in Tulsa at one time called
Tulsa Tribune?
That's where that word comes from, too. Two tribunes who were installed with power equal to the consuls and the protection of the state. They even gained the right to have their own assembly, and they could elect people to represent them there. And this election was called a plebiscite. Heard that word before? We still have plebiscites now and then, don't we? A lot of times it's an attempt to reverse something, but in this case it was something positive. The next big deal, though, and I've got to read you some things from it, the 12 tables. They came up in 450 B.C. with a passage of laws. And why would it be a big deal to have laws inscribed on stone and published for everybody to see?
Harder to change that
way. Harder to change, and supposedly everybody has to live with the same rules. You're not quite at the whim of whoever happens to be in power.
Mm-hmm. And like the Ten
Commandments. Kind of like the Ten Commandments, yeah.
Kind of the expression written in stone. Huh?
Yeah. I just wanted to read you a couple of them, because they're kind of weird. The execution for the law, execution table number 3, execution, the law of debt. When a debt has been acknowledged or judgment about the matter has been pronounced in court, 30 days must be the legitimate time of grace. After that, the debtor may be arrested by laying on of hands. I don't like this kind of laying on of hands, do you? Bring him into court. If he does not satisfy the judgment or no one in court offers himself as surety on his behalf, the creditor may take the defaulter with him. He may bind him either in stocks or in fetters, and unless they make a settlement, debtors shall be held in bond for 60 days. During that time, they shall be brought before the creditor's court in the meeting place on 3 successive market days, and the amount for which they are judged liable shall be announced. On the 3rd market day, they shall suffer capital punishment or be delivered up for sale right across from the Tiber. See, we sold for bad debts.
Okay, where was across the Tiber? Really
the Tiber was farther north. Do you remember when Caesar came back? He had to cross the Rubicon, and then the next one down was the Tiber. And it actually runs down through Rome.
Yeah, but there must have been
a bad country. Oh, yeah. That was where the barbarians were. The right of head of family, that's table 4. You may quickly kill a deformed child. If a father 3 times surrenders a son for sale, the son shall be free from the father. A child born 10 months after the father's death will not be admitted into a legal inheritance. That one may be logical and you know, useful.
Yeah.
Yeah. 10 months later, he's not your legitimate son. So they're not all bad. Just some of them. Guardianship. What about women? Where do they fit into all this? There was a certain amount of freedom of women and their women of note, who, because of their influence on their husbands, had significant influence. But they forever had to have a guardian, even if they were wealthy in their own right. Their husband, or if the husband died, their eldest son, supervised their financial affairs. Females shall remain in guardianship even when they have attained their majority. If a man is raving mad, a rightful authority over his person is chattel so it can belong to his agnates, nearest male relatives, or to his clansmen. A spendthrift is forbidden to exercise administration over his own goods. A person who, being insane or a spendthrift, is prohibited from administering his own goods shall be under the trusteeship of agnates. And there's more. I only read the three. But the significance of the 12 tables is that they were supposed to be applied equally to everybody. I guess that's a good step in the right direction, you know. Because we do appear to live in a country that has reference back to the Constitution sometimes. Oops, politically incorrect there. And this happened, by the way, in 450 B.C. And as I mentioned, they're harsh by modern standards, but they did create a state where all Roman citizens were equal under the law. Think about, for example, when Paul was arrested. Mm-hmm. He was brought before Jewish courts. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, he did what?
He was
a Roman citizen. He therefore wanted to go to Rome to be charged, and they did it.
Mm-hmm.
So having a Roman citizenship did have an advantage. Now, he still ended up dead, but not for a while, and he still had an impact on the people he met when he was in Rome. Lived quite a while, what, 2-3 years in custody? Something like that.
Significantly, he was able to write letters from prison.
And meet with people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it was like house arrest, but people could come and go.
As a woman, could you be a Roman citizen or not?
Not really. You're kind of like...
Because you had no rights.
You had certain rights, but you didn't have all the rights.
Okay.
Yeah. And if you had boys, you know, your status went up because you were the mother of the boy.
Okay.
If you had girls, not so good. The family was the basis of Roman society. And this head honcho in the family was called the paterfamilias. This is where, if I had my thing, I'd write it down for you. Who had absolute control over the family members, in theory at any rate. The family, and I never thought of this before, the family represented a miniature state. The father was the head of it. Young men who would eventually form their own related families lived there. They ultimately became a clan. The children and others who lived in the same household, the tutors, the slaves, the artisans, all lived there. And if you see pictures of some of the early Roman houses, they're a little bit like something you might see out of the Middle East. And I'm not terribly surprised at that. They're built around a courtyard. And with rooms for several different members of the family. And you would live together as a family. You know, I guess I'm kind of showing myself here, but if you think about it, you don't have to go back very many years when our society had the same kind of thing,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Where families basically stuck together and took care of mothers or fathers who were older and unable to care for themselves. They lived together as a family. That's not quite so common anymore, is it? Of course, we're living longer,
mm-hmm.
A lot longer, but...
That's why what Tom was talking earlier about the fact that from the cross of John 19, he's talking to his mother and said, "Behold your son," speaking of his disciple, mm-hmm. John, and then he said, "Behold your mother." That departure from the normal within the Jewish community, which was first the father, then the elder son, then the next elder son.
Right.
If Jesus being on the cross and the elder son, the next elder son would have been James, and he was not even involved in this discussion.
Yeah, not that part.
So the family, all of a sudden, he changed the landscape.
Right. It's a system of mutual obligations, basically, that was built into this society. The period from 264 to 133 B.C., we're not even up to the time of Christ yet, was a time marked by many wars of conquest, both in nearby lands and in territories far away. Some of these I can tell you where they are, but some I haven't a clue. Volscians, Sabines. Remember hearing about the Sabine women? Aquii, the Gauls. Where was that?
France.
That's France. The Celts.
Scotland, Britain.
And France. They were all over that part. And the Carthaginians, and I mentioned where they were from North Africa. By the end of it, Rome controlled much of the land around the Mediterranean Sea. From Spain and northern England. Do you remember where Hadrian's Wall is? Kind of cuts between England and Scotland. That was the northernmost point. All the way to down to Sudan today, from clear over around the Red Sea, the Persian Gulf, to the Atlantic Ocean. That was all Roman territory. Thousands of miles held together by the roads and their legions. And those roads I mentioned last week are some that you can still see if you go to Rome. They're kind of bumpy, but they're sure doing better than Oklahoma roads. They're still around 2,000 years later. And the legions, supposedly, I can't get my numbers straight, each legionnaire would carry a pack of, I think it was 60 pounds, and could march 20 miles per day. Now, I have walked 20 miles in a day, and I was pooped, and I didn't have a 60-pound pack, and I didn't do it day after day.
Well, I can remember my father talking about when he was in the First World War, that was what a foot soldier was expecting, a 60-pound, and walked 20 miles.
But did you march from Rome to the northern reaches of England?
I don't know where it was.
Yeah, my point is they would send out these legions if they had the possible hint of trouble. And they would send out a legion or two to go deal with it, and they would march for days on end. Because they didn't have tanks, they didn't have cars, they didn't have trains. They would march. What a tremendous structure they built with the legions and the roads and so forth, tying it all together. I skipped some stuff, but I want to talk about religion just a little bit. It permeated every aspect of Roman society. Where did they get the names for their gods? Or where did they get their gods? Let me back up.
Greek
gods. They just changed the names in many cases. Yes, sir.
I just thought about something that was a parallel that I had never thought about before. The Greeks had gods, and those gods in their mythology would come down to earth on many occasions and have female spouses. And they would have offspring that would become the heroes.
Mm-hmm.
Think about Genesis 6 when we're talking about the Nephilim, or the fallen angels would come down to earth, cohabit with females, and have men of renown, they call it in Scripture, but basically they were the giants. They were the Goliath of Gath and all his... there were all these giants that were on the earth that were offspring of this union between...
What was the word, Anakim?
Nephilim. The Nephilim is one word, and there's that...
Anakim and Nephilim?
The primary word was Nephilim, and I think... it means fallen angels, basically.
It's very similar.
But it struck me that it's kind of parallel a little bit with what the Greeks were saying.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of wonder who got what from whom.
Hermes became Mercury... Demeter became Ceres, Apollo and Asclepius, they were adopted. Later on during the empire, of course, they added one. Who was the god they added?
Who?
The emperor. You had to worship the emperor during the empire. So they added one. Not Julius Caesar, but later on it became. Generally speaking, however, their religion was, and I want to read you a quote, it was not morality but the exact performance of ritual that was crucial to establishing a right relationship with the gods. It isn't what you believed, it's what you did.
Mm-hmm.
There's a nice little parallel there too.
Yeah, really.
But it was what you did. And some of the people of greatest power and authority were the high priests, because they were responsible for performing the ceremonies. And if they performed the ceremonies right and things worked out well, that even exalted them even more. I suppose if you performed them wrong and you lost the war, I don't know what happened to you then. But they established a college of three pontiffs. P-O-N-T-I-M-F. Mm. Ever heard that word?
Yeah.
Wasn't that the Pater Familias? That's what the Pope is today.
He's the head of the family in a sense, but he's also the pontiff.
Yeah, oh yes.
He's the pontiff. He's the Pope today. He was responsible for all state religious laws and ceremonies. In essence, these individuals became the head of the religious department of state, and ultimately the Roman success in building an empire was due in success to having a right relationship with the gods. And then they had family gods. Remember I said the family was like the state? They even had their own family gods in their house. Annual festivals were celebrated where they had chariot races, hunts, and gladiatorial contests. So at the beginning, even back in the time of the Republic.
The family gods, now, is that the thing that Rachel took when she was?
Same kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mentioned there was no such thing as public education, and I've got just a little dab left. No such thing as public education in ancient Rome. Boys and girls were taught in the patrician families to gather for a while. Now, unlike the Spartans, where the girls got one thing and the boys got shuffled off to the military at age 7, most of the time, if the family was wealthy, they had tutors. But reading back, and I just discovered this one the other day because I hadn't read this particular book. I used a different one to teach from. But if they couldn't afford a private tutor to teach their kids full-time, sometimes these Greek slaves and freedmen started schools. And the next level of Romans would send their kids to school. So they actually had schools where they taught reading, writing, arithmetic, rhetoric, and Greek literature. Not Roman, Greek. Yeah. What's rhetoric?
Debating.
Debating. Why did you want them to be good debaters?
Maybe they might end up being a politician.
That's exactly right. They wanted them to become senators. I mean, as a way of raising the family authority and influence. So they taught rhetoric in their schools. They wanted to be able to manage their family and home and ultimately the country. Arranged marriages were a common form of marriage. How old would the girls be? 14, 15? How old would the men be? 30 or so. Part of the reason with this is that the men would have more than one wife successively, not at the same time.
Oh.
How come?
Childbirth.
Yeah. And interestingly, Sid, several years ago I was in Richmond, Virginia, and we were with National Geographic, and we went to a cemetery in Richmond, and this thing was so striking that here'd be a tombstone for a man. Wife number one, wife number two, wife number three. And oh my gosh. And you look at the dates. Dialed in childbirth, almost all of them. If you got through your childbearing years, women would outlive the men, quite often. The childbearing was deadly for many of these young ladies. The second thing to marry them early was to collect their dowry. What's a dowry?
It's paid by the family.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it sounds like a bribery, doesn't it?
Bribery.
Bribery. You take my daughter, and I'll even pay you to take her. You know, this kind of thing. That was the dowry. I don't know.
It's a way of breaking their plate when they're used to it.
Okay. Though marriage was supposed to be for life, interestingly, divorce was not uncommon, especially in the turbulent years at the end of the Republic. But this is the interesting thing, Judy. You were looking at, and Anne, you were asking about women. Women were not as secluded as they were in ancient Athens. They could go out, they bought goods, they could buy food, they were in charge of the home, as far as that kind of thing is concerned. They did have some authority over that. And then, as I mentioned, some examples wielded power through their husbands. And let me tell you, that you, if you've had daughters, men, you realize that daughters and wives can kind of twist you around your little finger at times. The Roman Republic fell somewhere around the period of 133 to 31 B.C. That was the end of the Republic, and I don't want to go into all the wars, but there was a series of wars fought by Gracchus brothers, Sulla, Marius, Pompey, Crassus, and finally Julius Caesar. And basically, he's the one you have to give the credit to for bringing the Roman Republic to a screeching halt when he crossed the Rubicon, had defeated the Gauls, came back into Rome itself, and lasted about 3 years as the dictator, and then the senators did him in. If you remember reading Julius Caesar in literature, A. Q. Brute and so forth, they got him back. Interestingly enough, who took his place? Didn't call him that yet. Octavian. Octavian was his, interestingly, his nephew, and he was his adopted son because he had no children of his own. So he adopted his nephew, Octavian, and Octavian formed what they call the second triumvirate with Pompey and Crassus, and they proceeded to clean house. There was a list, and if your name got on the list, you're probably going to be dead. They estimate that somewhere around 2,000 people were assassinated as a result of their killing of Caesar. Mm-hmm. Most of the senators ended up dead. And anybody else that they thought had been involved in any way or was in any condition to challenge their authority. He emerged as a dominant leader, and empire period is usually considered to go from 31 B.C. to 476 A.D. Finally, there, with the anointing of the Senate, Octavian got a title called Augustus. That's where he got the name. And how did he manage to get the surviving senators, who probably were in fear of their life, worked out a compromise with him, and they gave him a title, Augustus, which means the revered one. In appearance, it was a constitutional monarchy, though not in reality. In reality, it was an absolute monarchy. Total and absolute. I want to read you, just before I finish, his list of achievements. The funny part, this is as he's an old man. He wanted history to know how he did. So he wrote them. This is his list of his accomplishments. Yeah.
Revisionist.
Exactly. At the age of 19, and that was how old he was when Julius Caesar was assassinated, on my own initiative and at my own expense, I raised an army of means with which I liberated the Republic. First spin right there. Which was oppressed by the tyranny of a faction, Mark Antony and his supporters. Two, those who assassinated my father, who was his adopted father, I drove into exile, avenging their crime by due process of law. Right. And afterwards, when they waged war against the state, I conquered them twice on the battlefield. I waged many wars throughout the whole world, by land and by sea, both civil and foreign. And when victorious, I spared all citizens who sought pardon. The dictatorship offered to me by the people and the Senate. Mm-hmm. Both in my absence and in my presence, I refused to accept. I chose not to be a dictator. Instead, I became Augustus.
Good thing he wasn't delusional.
Yeah, exactly. The Senate decreed that vows for my health should be offered every fifth year by the consuls and the priests. In fulfillment of these vows, games were to be celebrated during my lifetime. And he goes into listing all the games, like the chariot races and the gladiatorial contest. Four times I came to the assistance of the treasury with my own money. Of course, where did he get it? Transferring to those in charge of the treasury 150 million sesterces, and in the consulship of Marcus Lepidus and Lucius, I transferred out of my own patrimony 170 million more to the Soldiers Bonus Fund, which was established on my advice for the purchase of providing bonuses for soldiers who had completed 20 or more years of service. I repaired the Capitol and the Theater of Pompeii. I gave a gladiatorial show 3 times in my own name and 5 times in the names of my sons or grandsons. I brought peace to the sea by suppressing the pirates. In that war, I turned over to their masters for punishment nearly 30,000 slaves who had run away from their owners and taken up arms against me in the state. I extended the frontiers of all the provinces of the Roman people. I added Egypt to the empire of the Roman people. I established colonies of soldiers in Africa, Sicily, Macedonia, and both Spanish provinces, in Achaia, Asia, Syria, Narbonese, Gaul, and Pisidia, Italy. Moreover, I had 28 colonies established by me, which in my lifetime have grown to be famous and populous. Poor guy, he just worked himself to death, didn't he? You think, how great I am, yeah. I know, I think, okay.
He didn't have a problem prior.
No, he was humble, yeah. Just ask him. Just ask him. And the empire grew to its largest extent during his period, though. From Hadrian's Wall to the south of Egypt, and for the sake of speed, see if you can name some of the contributions of the Romans. And they did have many. It wasn't just this guy. The roads. Mm-hmm. What else?
Aqueduct.
What's an aqueduct?
Way of moving water.
It's like a water bridge. Mm-hmm. Literally, they built these water bridges that would bring the water from the mountains to the city. And it worked. It worked. They brought in fresh water. You needed it if you had a large city.
The use of concrete.
Use of concrete, which you had to line the aqueduct with. Otherwise, it leaked. Mm-hmm. They also used it to build the Colosseum. The language, the Latin language. Mm-hmm. And though we don't use it today, per se, it's a basis for a lot of English words.
Well, it's also the basis from French, mm-hmm. Italian, English, Spanish.
Romance. That's the language. That's one of the languages in Switzerland. And Romanian. Guess where they got the name for that country. Here's a few that maybe you don't know. Thermal baths. So you could go to a spa. And they had hot water, running water, cold water. And you'd take a bath. You'd go soak in the sauna. And then you take a hot water bath, go back to the sauna, and then you jump in the cold pool.
That was also the source of their depravity.
That could be. Floor heating. They heated the floors. I kind of like that idea. Radiant heating under your floor. That's one of the things I miss about not having a basement. My feet get cold in the winter. Wine making. They borrowed the idea. But they made all sorts of interesting wines, which I think probably most of us have tasted anyway. Chianti, the Roman alphabet, the Roman numerals, the Roman legal system, which is the basis of many European legal systems to this day. What's the other legal system followed in Europe that's not Roman? This is another aside. The Napoleonic Code.
The Napoleonic Code, the only place now is that's in existence is Louisiana.
Yeah, yeah. But it was an offshoot. The Roman Republic Senate, the idea of modern democracy. The Julian calendar. Guess what? We just came through July. What month are we in at the moment? Guess who it's named after. And the funniest one I found, the three-course meal.
Three-course meal.
I don't want to eat what he ate.
What were the three courses?
Well, you had an appetizer, the pasta, your entree, and the dessert. And, you read about some of the orgies they had at the meals. Most of that was fanciful. I don't know that really it happened that often. But a lot of times they did have more than one course.
And that expanded in Europe to
five courses and eight courses and all sorts of things.
Yeah, many hour courses.
And yet, despite all the contributions of the Romans, I want to read you something else to finish. Here is a man who was born in an austere village, the child of a peasant woman. He grew up in another village. He worked in a carpenter shop until he was 30. Then for 3 years he was an itinerant preacher. He never owned a home. He never wrote a book. He never held an office. He never had a family. He never went to college. He never put his foot inside a big city. He never traveled 200 miles from the place he was born. He never did one of the things that usually accompany greatness. He had no credentials but himself. While still a young man, the tide of popular opinion turned against him. His friends ran away. One of them denied him. He was turned over to his enemies. He went through the mockery of a trial. He was nailed upon a cross between two thieves. While he was dying, his executioners gambled for the only piece of property he had on earth, his coat. When he was dead, he was laid in a borrowed grave to the pity of a friend. 19 long centuries have come and gone, and now it's 20. And today he's the centerpiece of the human race and leader of the column of progress. I am far within the mark when I say that all the armies that ever marched, and all the navies that were ever built, all the parliaments that ever sat, and all the kings that ever reigned put together, have not affected the life of man upon this earth as powerfully as has his one solitary life.
Amen.